I posted all about this guy, tweeted him like crazy when I sat in the congregation listening to him. You have got to get his stuff. And we're going to give you just a little piece of that right now. The author of A Call to Radical Discipleship and I'd Like to Believe in Jesus, But He Answers the Tough Questions. Welcome to the Dr. Gina Show, Bob Siegel.
Dr. Gina, it's an honor to be here. I had the privilege of meeting both your husband and producer after I spoke at Skyline. It's wonderful to meet you as well.
Well, and I'm sorry. I don't know what I do after church. I'm so weird in social situations. I kind of sometimes hide, but it's really, really, really good to have you on the show. I was very, very impressed with your message. I tweeted it. I asked people to watch the video. I had a ton of response from it, and so it's totally an honor to have you.
Well, I'll tell you what. If you're that impressed, then you need to become a guest on my show as well.
Well, I think we might be able to work something like that out.
Okay.
I don't hide from media. I just hide at church. I'm not sure why. It's odd. but anyway, I do want to ask you some questions. Folks have already posted a ton of questions for you, and I want to get right down to those because I've never heard anybody answer things the way you all answered them. And it was funny. It was entertaining, but I want to get right to them. And one for me, I don't know if you saw this week, but Joseph Farah, who, of course, is the editor at WorldNet Daily that I write for, he posted that his dog had died, and he posted this amazing eulogy to his dog, and I answered him with a testimony from a senator from Missouri that I just absolutely love about his dog, and it's called Old Drum, if anybody wants to Google that right now, and Senator Vest was his name, and I want to know, I love pets, and there's something magical and godly in spirit about them, and I want to know, will we see them again? Please do tell.
Okay, well, I have to start by saying I was listening to part of your show before I came on, and I'm a cat lover, too. So I need to start by saying that if there is an afterlife for cats, I believe mine is going straight to hell. She's very cute, and that's why I keep her. She's adorable, but that is the only redeeming virtue. I mean, I love cats. They're stubborn. They're finicky. They're a lot like me, I should say. But, you know, actually, Dr. Gina, I've been hearing Christians for years say, well, animals won't be in heaven because animals don't have souls. And the Bible says absolutely nothing about pets and the afterlife. But C.S. Lewis, the very famous author and philosopher, he was not afraid to tackle those kinds of questions. He's written a fascinating book, which I think you would enjoy, called The Problem with Pain. And in The Problem with Pain, there's one chapter called Animal Pain. And he made a very interesting observation. He is of the belief that he wasn't of the belief that all animals, anybody in the animal kingdom, when they die, they're going to go into heaven. I mean, you know, what do you do with mosquitoes?
Right,
but
right.
He was of the opinion that if there were animals that are important to us as human beings, if they're important to us and we're important to God, then they would be important to God. He was also of the belief that animals develop their personalities with their rapport with human beings. And, you know, C.S. Lewis would be the first person to say, look, this is my opinion. I'm not claiming this in the Bible, just throw it out if you don't believe it. But I appreciated the fact that he would push the envelope and explore those kinds of things. And he felt that since we were made in the image of God, that something spiritual in the creation process could even take place between us and our pets. So he was of the opinion that our pets that are beloved to us will actually be in heaven. I know that I was watching a documentary a few years ago, and they were talking about the fact that zoologists who study animal behavior for years have only felt that it was worth their time to study animals in their natural habitat. And for years, owners of pets were saying, look, you need to meet my dog. You need to meet my cat. They have this amazing personality, and it's unlike other dogs or cats I've owned. Mm-hmm. And zoologists never wanted to take that seriously. And in the last few years, they are taking seriously the fact that animals seem to develop more of a personality when they're around human beings. So I would say I'm of the opinion that you will see your pets in heaven, but is there a verse that would tell you that? No, but there's no verse which says that they're not in heaven either, and I do wish my fellow Christians, my fellow brothers and sisters in Christ, when the Bible's silent about something, I think it's fine for them to continue to give their opinion, but they shouldn't fill in the blanks by pretending something's in the Bible that isn't actually there.
Absolutely. And while we are on the topic of a merciful and loving God who is, of course, in touch with his creation at all times, including their deepest thoughts and their deepest feelings, why would that same loving God cast his own creation into hell?
It's a very fair question. And I am of the belief that God's standards, his moral standards, were programmed right into our DNA. And that in our conscience, and therefore our institutions as human beings, we reflect God's standards. And in our court systems, we reflect something very similar to hell. If we had a judge who let a murderer go free, or rapists go free, and I, you know, oftentimes in the news today we meet such judges, but when that happens, any decent person says that is an irresponsible and therefore unloving judge. What I'm saying is our own court systems and criminal systems show that we believe in something very much like a hell. Everybody, if you really get them down to brass tacks and really talk honestly with them and get them to probe inside, will admit that they agree with God's standards. For example, I get this all the time. People will say, I don't believe a loving God would send people to hell. And I say, well, let me ask you a question. Do you believe a loving God would send people to heaven? And they say, oh, well, yeah, sure, of course, he'll send people to heaven. So then I'll say, well, who's in heaven? And of course, the first answer is, well, everybody. Everybody's in heaven. I said, really? Everybody. Murderers and racists are going to heaven. Adolf Hitler's going to be in heaven. Saddam Hussein's going to be in heaven. Doesn't sound like much of a heaven. And then at that point they go, oh, well, no, of course, obviously those people won't be there. Because the minute they admit that there's evil in heaven, then they're admitting that heaven isn't a paradise. Heaven's supposed to be a place where you live happily ever after for all of eternity. So they go, well, no, those people won't be in heaven. I say, okay, well, then where will those people be if they have an eternal soul? And all of a sudden you realize that for God to be a loving God, he's got to separate people out.
All right, and I think that answer, you know, for me is pretty easy to understand. I just know it's one of the main questions I get from people who are stumbling over this "how do I believe" question, because I have people like my own father. I call him Lib Dad affectionately here on the show. He believes pretty much counter the opposite of anything that I believe, but it makes for some good discussion. And he says he's asked Jesus into his heart 5 times. He is still mostly, you know, somewhere between atheist, agnostic, maybe softening just a little in his age. But for those people who it's hard to believe, these are some of their most common questions. One question that somebody asked on my Facebook page today is, who is the Antichrist?
Well, the Bible hasn't told us who the Antichrist is. The Bible tells us, and just to put this in context for your listeners, Antichrist and another title in the New Testament called Son of Perdition. Those are general titles given for a being who's going to come someday when we get into the last generation before Christ returns. Now, there are a lot of Christians, talking again about Christians filling in the blanks, who say we are in those in that last generation. We don't actually know that for a fact. It's possible. And when I look at all that's going on today, it wouldn't surprise me at all. But Jesus says nobody knows the day or the hour. We do know, though, that prior to Christ's coming, there's going to be a very charismatic leader with worldwide fame. And the Bible calls him the Antichrist. The Bible has given us a clue, though. In the book of Revelation, we're told that his number is 666. Now, according to Hebrew numerology, and I'm not into numerology, I'm not suggesting that anybody get into that or any other occult, but in the ancient Hebrew language, they did believe that a number corresponded with each letter. And in ancient Hebrew numerology, 666 was the name for Nero. So what they're saying is, and the Revelation was written about 90 AD, that's several decades after Emperor Nero, who was the first emperor to actually persecute Christians. So basically the Bible is saying, watch for somebody like Nero, a tyrannical dictator. So we don't know who he is, and Christians have made dumb guesses over the years. I remember when Ronald Reagan was president, people were saying, Ronald Wilson Reagan, 3 different names.
And oh, all with sixes. Oh, gosh, yeah. Okay, so you know,
we've got to be careful. What that number means is it's going to be somebody with a tyrannical reign and kind of personality as Emperor Nero.
All right. You hear the music. You know how this works because you're a show host as well. Can you hang with us through the break?
Absolutely. Awesome. I'll hang on as long as you want me.
Got a couple more questions. Super. Coming back in a moment with Bob Siegel, author of I'd Like to Believe in Jesus, but we're throwing all your hardest questions at him. Go ahead and put those up on the Facebook page right now. Gina Gentry Loudon. We'll be back in just a moment this Theological Thursday here on The Dr. Gina Show. And you are listening to The Dr. Gina Show, where we are breaking down things theological with you today. It is great to be with you here from the beach, live with the wind blowing my hair into my mouth most of the show. On the show with me today, somebody who just knocked my socks off. It's not very often. I get requests to be on the show every day. I refer them. They go through the funnel of production. But this guy, I saw him. I said, get him on the show. And that is Bob Siegel, graduate of Denver Seminary, San Jose State University. He's also a talk radio show host and popular guest speaker at churches and college campuses across the country. He has written two phenomenal books, A Call to Radical Discipleship and I'd Like to Believe in Jesus, But. You know, I get that question all the time. Privately messaged to me on Facebook, on Twitter. People know I'm a Christian. They say, I really want to believe. I get this from atheists all the time. A lot of times atheists who have first attacked me, usually on Twitter, sometimes on Facebook, and then they'll say, you know, there's something different. I see your spirit. I want that. I don't have it. My own dad is one of those people who just cannot seem to get that down. And being sort of a Calvinist myself, I'm just always praying about these things. So I wanted to have Bob on the show. Welcome back to the show, Bob. The questions continue. On the topic of numerology, which you brought up, Sly asks, on that note, why is numerology so prevalent in the Bible if it is considered a cult? I thought that was a great question.
Yeah, well, the answer to that is a great question, and I appreciate it. It's not prevalent in the Bible. What I mentioned when I mentioned the 666, meaning Nero's name, was a rare time that it's in the Bible. Now, there are books today like the Bible Code, and there are people that try to impose numerology on the Bible, but it's not that prevalent, and we need to be careful. The Bible does warn of things that belong to the occult, to God's enemy, in the spiritual world named Satan. So we need to stay away from numerology, tarot cards, Ouija boards, seances, right. Horoscope. I realize that we should probably come back and do a whole show on that sometime. That would get us off into a tangent. But it was true that even Hebrews who didn't believe in any kind of mystical numerology, in their language they did have a corresponding number with letters. And the word 666 was the name for Nero. That doesn't mean that Nero's going to become reincarnated. The Bible doesn't believe in reincarnation either. But we're just to watch for somebody like Nero. And I should say, when Nero first came into power, he was very different. His first 5 years, he was a really nice guy. He was a very benevolent leader. The Apostle Paul went on trial before Nero twice. The first time, Nero let him go and encouraged him and sent him off on his third missionary journey. The next time Paul found himself in front of Nero years later, that was after the great fire of Rome had started. People accused Nero of starting it. Whether he did or not, we don't know. He probably did, but we do know that he blamed Christians for it. And the Apostle Paul and Peter were both executed under Emperor Nero in 64 AD. This leader, the Antichrist, getting back to that original question, you know, he'll be a likable, charismatic figure at first. He will show his true colors later on, and that, too, will make him similar to Nero.
But back to the topic of numerology for just a moment, because this fascinates me. As I attempt, in my futility, to teach my children math, as I look at the order of the planets, the stars, I realize that, you know, order is so important to God. Like, he just spells it out again and again in creation. And it is to me that through that order, through that math, I want to almost say the words through numerology, even if you get to the order of birth in families, all these things seem to be very significant in understanding, I guess, the heart of God. And so mathematics.
Yeah, I mean, mathematics is that's a fascinating study. That's not the same as mystical numerology, but
so the distinction can you make the distinction for me? Because I do get confused when I look at things. I'm just going to say this straight up. I can't believe I'm saying this. When I look at things like horoscopes, and I look at things like when people were born, there are some lines you can draw that seem to me that aren't accidental. I'm not saying that you should get into all that stuff. I realize that is the occult, and I absolutely dissuade that and rebuke that in my own children. But I'm saying that God didn't just have someone born on a certain day by accident. He ordered that. It's mathematical, yes. So where do you draw those lines of distinction?
Where we draw the lines of distinction is from God's point of view. Whatever math and science he put into our creation is fine. When we try to use math to figure out Bible prophecies or get into the unknown or get information about the future, God set up one way for us to obtain that information, and that is that he did send people throughout the years called prophets, Moses being the first of them, and Jeremiah being an example of another one. And even prophets are to be tested. We're warned to beware of false prophets. So that is the distinction. The distinction is that we are not to try to use mathematics to figure out prophecy, but to use mathematics to figure out something like Einstein's, understand his brilliant equation about time and energy. And yeah, that's wonderful. The Bible tells us that God is removed from time. And when you start studying quantum physics, quantum physicists are saying things about God or saying things about time, I should say, time and space, that the Bible once said mm-hmm. about time and space. So, yeah, so that, mathematics is a fascinating thing. And I realize that the word math and the word numerology, they both have numbers in it, but they're very, very different things.
Yeah, and I agree. The math, and especially the quantum physics, as you're saying, does confirm so much of what I know to be true about God.
And there are certainly numbers that God seems to like. And again, that's not the same as numerology. God uses the number 40 a lot. He uses the number 7 a lot, corresponding mm-hmm. with the 6 days of creation. 3 is probably a popular number because it could stand for the Trinity. So again, God's big on numbers. God invented numbers. That it's not exactly the same as numerology.
It's the mystical that we need to avoid.
Yeah, yes, okay. It's the mystical view of numerology that we want to avoid.
Here's another one. Peter, 1 Peter 3:15 says that all Christians should be ready to give a defense of our belief to anyone who asks us the reason for the hope that we have. Are Christians today woefully unprepared to answer their own questions, much less the hard questions of others? That question from Letitia.
Christians today are not very well prepared. I appreciated all the kind and wonderful things you said about my presentation at Skyline. Mm-hmm. But one of the reasons that probably looked so amazing is that we don't see that a lot.
And yeah.
We should be seeing more of it. Gina, in all the years that people have been asking me questions, I've found that there's only about 7 questions that people ask. And they're great questions. They're important questions. They're questions of depth. They're questions that we ought to provide answers for. But they're only about 7. There's variations off of them, of course. But they're only about 7 broad questions. So if we're a Christian, how hard could it be to study the answer to 7 questions? So that's why a part of my ministry is not only sharing apologetics and answering questions, but I like to equip other Christians to answer those questions as well.
And I think it's so important to be ready with those 7 questions. And I'm guessing, because I have not read your book, I'm embarrassed. My kids are reading it right now. I only have 1 copy. But in your book, I'd Like to Believe in Jesus, are those 7 questions addressed?
We have those questions. Actually, in that book, some of the broader questions I didn't get into in the book, because what my book did is it dealt with some of the things that Christians tend to shove under the rug.
Oh.
Like, how is God going to deal with the people that never heard of the gospel? And what about those Old Testament wars? And is the Bible really a chauvinistic book? And I don't believe it is. But so we deal with those, and we deal with some of the broader questions as well. But the subtitle of my book, it's called I'd Like to Believe in Jesus, But... dot, dot, dot. But the subtitle is The Harder, Less Frequently Discussed Questions. Having said that, the book is written in a very pop style. I kind of put a lot of the scholarship and quotes of scholars in the footnotes, and in the main narrative, I tried to make it very readable with lots of stories. And your kids have probably discovered this. There's kind of an imaginary skeptic that's arguing with me throughout the book. And everything you see the imaginary skeptic say, somebody, a college student, a college professor, or just somebody off the street, somebody at one time asked me those questions. And the feedback that I've gotten, and I have had Christians tell me that they've put that book in the hands of their non-believing friends and have actually seen them come to know Christ afterwards, the feedback that I've gotten is just when a skeptic is ready to read one of my arguments and go, okay, yeah, but what about this? The skeptic on the pages says it right there. They're going, oh my gosh, I was just about to ask that. And the imaginary skeptic said it right in the book. And what that does is it establishes empathy with the reader right away. But I have two audiences in mind, not only the skeptic, but also the Christian who's looking for better answers to give to their friends.
Yeah, it's so important, and relatives. okay, last question. I posted
sure.
this morning. I tend to get up in the morning, and if I'm in a hurry, I will read Compass International's little Bible studies. I don't know if you're familiar, but I tend to enjoy them very much. And there are some theological, doctrinal differences probably among all Christians, no matter how dedicated they are to learning. But this is what it said today, that there are many well-known Bible teachers who are probably Christians, and this is quoting Compass now, that wrongly teach the concept that the church has inherited God's promises to the Jewish people. This is referred to as replacement theology. Those who believe replacement theology believe God finished dealing with Israel at the cross. They believe that when Jesus comes back, there is no reign of Christ on earth for 1,000 years, even though the Bible specifically says 5 times that he will reign, and then it goes through the citations of those. Great debate ensued on my Facebook page after I posted this, just as something that I was wanting feedback on. Can you clarify for us your position on replacement theology?
Well, let me tell you something first about theology. Theological systems are usually developed by individuals who get fascinated with one idea. Mm-hmm. And then they get so fascinated with that one idea that they start in time interpreting everything else in the Bible through the lens of that one idea. Mm-hmm. For example, John Calvin got fascinated with the sovereignty of God.
Oh, now careful.
So he started saying, well, God is... I know you're a Calvinist, but you're such a cool person. I know you can handle it, even if we don't agree with everything. I just sense that about you, Gina. You're so laid back and cool. This is not going to be a problem at all for us, but... John Calvin got so fascinated with the sovereignty of God that after a while he said, well, if God is sovereign, then anything that happens, God's in a way making it happen, and thus we don't have free will. Now, there was another person named Jacob Arminius. He got so fascinated with the free will of human beings that he pushed the limits and said, well, if human beings have free will, then we could even lose our salvation.
Yeah, now we can talk. I actually agree
with the Calvinists when they say we can't lose our salvation, but I agree with Jacob Arminius when he says we have free will. So I don't usually fit real neatly into either. Now, getting back to replacement theology, again, the truth is somewhere in the middle. Replacement theology says the promises that God gave to Israel, Israel blew that, and now those promises go to their church. As with most theological arguments, the people are partly right and partly wrong. It's true that early in Romans, Paul says there is also such a thing as being a Jew spiritually, that if one gives their life to Christ, the promises that God gave Israel apply to them. You don't have to be born Jewish. You don't have to be a descendant of Abraham. But when he gets to Romans chapter 11, the same book, he says God's not done with the Israelites yet either. And he compares it to a tree. He says, imagine Israel was this natural tree and some of the individual branches were disobedient. He says, God has this promise that Israel as a nation, as a people, the nation's going to be fine someday. But, you know, Gina, a nation can be fine without every individual being fine. We won World War II when we fought against Germany. America won that war, but many individual American soldiers died during that war. But you make that spiritual. An individual, by the way, I do come out of a Jewish background, so I'll just say very clearly and honestly, an individual Jew that does not give their life to Jesus Christ, they are not going to end up in heaven. But there are certain prophecies about God delivering Israel as a nation someday that are still going to come true. So Paul compares this to a tree, and he says, yeah, the tree's going to be fine, but any individual branch that goes bad, God will prune that branch off. And then he uses the analogy of taking branches from another wild tree and grafting them on. And as you know, a branch that can be staked into a tree can be grafted to the point where it actually grows in and connects and becomes part of that tree. So he compares the Gentile Christians with the wild branches from another tree that get grafted onto Israel's tree. And he compares some of the individual Jews who've fallen away with the branches that got cut off. But then he says something really interesting. He says, I warn you Gentiles not to become conceited. He says, the hardening on Israel is in part until the full number of Gentiles come in. Now, when you get to Revelation, Revelation has all kinds of symbolism in it. We need to be careful about developing too much theology from Revelation because it is very symbolic. To some people, it would look like someone had been on acid when they wrote it. Of course, John was not on acid. John was on the island of Patmos, and he got a vision from God. And some of those things will become clearer as we get to the time. And it is true that at the end of the book of Revelation, he says that when Christ returns, he will rule for 1,000 years. And some people say, okay, well, since that's in the book of Revelation, how do we know that 1,000 years isn't symbolic for something else? But if you go to a place like Romans chapter 11 that I just quoted from, where they're not talking about any reign of 1,000 years, but Paul is talking very clearly. This is not prophetic, apocalyptic literature. This is a very clear letter that he's writing to the Romans that a third grader can understand if they read it. He's making it very clear that God is not done with Israel. So is the church part of the new Israel? Yes. And replacement theology is partly right when they say that. But those who believe that God is not done with Israel as a nation and not done with the Jews, they are correct also. It's not an either-or thing. It's a both-and.
Well, that ought to keep the conversation going on my Facebook page.
Oh, of course.
Much, Bob. Well,
somebody's going to call me a heretic. And,
yeah.
And you know.
Well,
by the way, go ahead.
I was just going to say, I think the way to wrap this up, to be honest with you, is that we have to be so careful of idolatry. And I am not a pastor or a preacher of any sort, but we have to guard ourselves against this sort of idolatry that says that we have delved into a specific piece of scripture so thoroughly that and so exhaustively that perhaps we just need to lighten up a little bit and accept grace. I get to a point where some of these finer points are best left certainly to the greatest minds who do nothing but study them all day, every day, and certainly not to some talk show host somewhere or some armchair quarterback, you know, theologian. So not that that's what you are. I'm saying just those of us out on Facebook debating all of this. So anyway,
I agree. And there's really three different lists Christians need to have. One are the things that we absolutely must believe and agree on. Another one would be things that the Bible does not comment on, like the thing with pets, but we can still have an opinion, a real cool opinion, I should say. We can still have an opinion. And the other one would be things that the Bible is clear on, but they're still not so important that our salvation is based on it. So the three things we must agree on as Christians, who is Jesus Christ, why did he come, how are we saved? When we get into the end times, the second coming, the spiritual gifts, how God's going to deal with Israel as opposed to the church, that's interesting stuff, and I love going to Denny's and discussing it over a cup of coffee, and I love talking about it on my radio show. None of those things determine whether or not our soul is going to be with Jesus in heaven, so we do have to keep our perspective on that.
Perspective, and remember that there's always grace. All right, well, if anybody would like to have more answers to these tough questions, they're just going to have to get your books, A Call to Radical Discipleship, and also I'd Like to Believe in Jesus, But, or they can listen to your radio show. Where can they find you?
BobSiegel.net is my website, so there's plenty of information about my books and my radio show there. My radio show is on KCBQ 1170 Sunday nights at 6 o'clock Pacific time, but they could also go to my website and download back shows. There's a convenient search engine, so my show deals with both religion and politics. I should also mention that I write a column for Washington Times Communities called Forbidden Table Talk, meaning the two forbidden dinner table conversation, religion and politics.
Yes.
You know, you're sitting at the table and you're getting into the discussion, and sooner or later somebody goes, can we just change the subject? So
yes.
The whole idea is here on my radio show and in my column, Forbidden Table Talk, we do not change the subject. That's communities@washingtontimes.com, where they can find my column, my website, bobsiegel.net.
Awesome. Bob Siegel, thank you so much for being on the show. We'll be right back in just a moment. We're going to ask the question, you know, we were just asking the question, do we deserve hell? Now we're going to ask the question, do we deserve the IRS scandal? That topic and more coming up this Theological Thursday. Billy Hollowell coming up on This Week in Faith as well. Stay tuned. You're listening to The Dr. Gina Show.